Welcome to today's talk on Should India Strive for Westernization or Modernization? My name is Irina Sander. I have written a textbook, De Moderne India, which is written in Norwegian. And we do run rooms on various topics in this club. You can see the greenhouse up there, The Modern India. Today's guests are Erik Solheim. Erik is a Norwegian diplomat and former politician. He has held several positions in the Norwegian government, and he was executive director of the UN Environment Program for 2016 and 2018. We also have with us Suket Dhir. Suket is a textile and fashion designer. He has been featured on the cover page of several newspapers and magazines. He's also ranked as one of the 50 most influential Indians by the GQ magazine. So please make sure to follow all of them, Bharat, Erik, and Suket. I also have with me a super cool moderator, Bharat Ramanan. He creates some amazing rooms on Clubhouse on politics, music, and culture. He's also very well networked, so make sure you follow him as well. The topic for today's event is, should India strive for westernization or modernization? Westernization is about adaptation of Western values, while modernization is a change or modification which offers the promise of the preservation of the past. So this is one was my intro. Now I want to give the word to Bharat.
Rina, thanks so much, and it's a pleasure to be back in a room with Erik and with Suket. Suket I've known for many years now, and Erik I've had the opportunity of actually meeting many years ago, but he probably doesn't remember at any rate. But we did a room a couple of weeks, I think 2 weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, around various aspects of where India stands in a rather changed international order, and that was a fantastic conversation. I'm looking forward to this, Erik, and welcome to both you and Suket. I'll start off, Veena, if that's okay with you.
It's absolutely fine with me. Please go ahead, Bharat.
Thank you, Erik. So my first question on this topic, firstly, I think it's a fantastic one because I think there are plenty of nuances here, which, you know, in the current sort of environment where, topics like this are easily broad brushed, I want you to perhaps try and explain to our audience what you think is the difference between westernization and globalization slash modernization. And I'll let you go ahead, Erik.
Thank you so much. And of course, the discussion as to whether India should westernize or modernize is a question Indians need to decide, not me as a foreigner, but still I will offer some thoughts. And my thoughts are very clearly on the side that India should modernize and it should not westernize. And I would start pointing to what I consider the most successful modernization done by any nation. And that was the first non-European nation to modernize, and that was Japan. And I think that's a very, very clear answer to this question. I mean, the Japanese in the 1860s were attacked by American gunboats. The Americans wanted to open up Japan for trade, for international trade. Japan had been closed down basically for most relations to the rest of the world for nearly 300 years. And the Americans, in a very forceful way, wanted to open them up for American trade. Then a group of warriors and a group of bureaucrats in Japan looked into their odds, and they decided that if Japan was to survive, Japan wanted to remain strong, if they wanted strong again, they needed to modernize. So there was no way they could stand up to the Americans and to the West if they didn't modernize. But it's important to remember that modernizing for them was a method. The aim was to make Japan strong and to keep Japanese traditions and values. These were not revolutionaries. These were a group of conservative bureaucrats and samurai warriors, but with the aim of keeping Japanese values and Japan as a strong nation. And then they decided to modernize. And then they were able to, and then they kicked out the shogun, then they made the emperor more powerful, and they created a new modern Japanese state. Even this group of samurais and bureaucrats went on a 2 years mission, first to the United States, then to the United Kingdom, then to France and a good number of other European nations, to pick the best ideas for Japan. Not that I wanted to copy everything, but I wanted to pick what was most useful in the Japanese context. And they were enormously successful. Within a couple of decades, Japan had thousands of kilometers of railroads. Within 4 decades, Japan had an army so strong that they, as the first non-European nation, could beat a European nation at the battlefield. They won an enormous victory over Russia in 1905. First time a yellow or black or brown or whatever nation did beat a white nation after the colonialism started. So this modernization without westernization has been incredibly successful in Japan. Even when Japan was occupied by the Americans after the Second World War and adopted a number of American values, yes, and they still remain Japan. And no one today is in doubt that Japan has one of the most distinct cultures in the world. They have their own religions in Shintoism and Buddhism. They have their own language. And basically all traditions and patterns in Japan remain strong. Question is, of course, if India had not been under the colonial thumb of the United Kingdom, could India have done the same in the 19th century? And I believe the most likely answer to that is yes. Either India as a whole or Indian states, if they had been remained independent, they could have done some of the same as Japan did. You can find a number of reasons why this was more easy for Japan than for, say, African states. But still, I believe Japan stands as the best global example, the first, but also the most shining, of how you modernize without westernize. China, of course, recently has done a lot of the same, but we can come back to that later in the discussion.
Eric, that was really interesting that you brought up Japan as a case and as an example, and how Japan picked what was useful for Japan. And we all in the room know how Japan made the mark in the previous century. I saw that a few persons had raised their hands. This talk is recorded. So for 15-20 minutes, me and Bharat will address a few questions to Sukheta and Eric, and then we will open up for the audience. So please be a little bit patient, and you all will be invited to the stage. I would like to go over to you, Sukheta. How do you distinguish between westernization and modernization of the Indian culture?
Okay, so I will sort of give my perspective from my domain, since I'm a fashion and I'm into fashion and textiles and crafts. What I've actually been seeing is the first thing that you see when you come to India and when you come to the cities, you'll see people of India wear Western clothes when they go to offices, and these clothes are absolutely not suitable to Indian weather. I'm not saying that we go for impractical silhouettes of the past, but certainly the fabrics, the silhouettes can be more conducive to basically our situation and our environment. Another thing is, another example that I also noticed when I go for my weaving trips to the weaving clusters throughout India. Specifically, this is West Bengal. When I went to West Bengal, I stayed at my weaver's home, and this was his brand new home, which looked like any urban home from, say, a tier two or tier three cities, with marble flooring, with just concrete, just a normal concrete house. And for them, it was a matter of pride. They celebrated, but then they were actually sort of complaining. They were complaining about ants being on the floor. They're not being able to sort of. They're needing air conditioners. They're not being able to sort of do the normal things that they used to actually do. You know, the houses they were used to living. They used to be cool in the summer and warm in the winter, and that was something that was not true for the new pakka concrete houses. Now, although they look at the new pakka concrete houses as an upward mobility, but when it comes to practicality, it's actually sort of moving behind. It's deracinating from basically practicality and again tradition. What would be, and there have been a couple of movements here, but some people have actually made houses near Rishikesh and all of those. They've been building mud houses and all of those, but with modern plumbing, modern electricity, and many, many more. Like, you know, the air conditioning, if you take the air duct from under the floor for about 25 to 30 meters, you can actually get air, just natural air. You can cool the natural air from 40 degrees to 22 degrees by just passing it under the earth. So, I mean, these are the few little things that come to mind when I think about it. So, for me, it was, again, cherishing our tradition, but at the same time, modernizing with the new technological developments and other things that are happening around the world. So you don't lose a lot of the past, and you don't sort of stay insulated from the developments that are happening around the world. I have many more examples to share, but I will share them during the course of the discussion further. I mean, I have inputs about, you know, people traditionally working from home, which the whole world has actually learned about during the COVID times. But when you look at the craftsmen, when you see the craftsmen, traditionally, they've always been working from home. So, I mean, I'll elaborate on that later. Thank you.
Eric, you made some very interesting points with Japan as a notable example. Closer home towards our borders, I think China has also adopted a model of, should we say, modernization in their own way, without necessarily being westernized in the standard sense of the term. I'm just curious, because, you know, they are where they are on the world stage, how do you see that shape, and where do you think India could, you know, maybe take some pointers, perhaps? I understand that our systems politically are very different, but culturally, both countries have a rich tapestry, both in terms of civilization, but also in terms of the sort of, the demographic dividend that both countries enjoy.
I think this is a great question, and I believe that, yes, indeed, China and India are very different entities, but they also have something in common which we should also remember. I mean, if we go back in history, China and India were the most developed places on the earth. I mean, they combined may have had 60% or even 70% of the global economic production. So China and India were totally dominated in the world until the rise of the West, which started, say, around 1750. And then, of course, the Brits and the French and later the Americans came to dominate. And that was seen as the Chinese as the era of humiliation. In India, people will tend to speak about colonialism. In China, it will be the 100 years of humiliation, which was basically until the revolution early in the 20th century. Then, of course, the Chinese were looking for modern ideologies. Communism or Marxism at the time looked like maybe the most modern ideology in the world. The Russian Revolution had been enormously successful, at least that was the impression. And many young Chinese picked Marxism as the way to modernize China. But it's very important to remember that it was to make China great again, which was their main aim. Marxism was a tool, an idea to make China strong. And if you look to these people, Mao Zedong or Deng Xiaoping or Zhou Enlai, it was all about making China great and using Marxism as well. Today, of course, for all practical purposes, the Chinese have dropped Marxism. I mean, you can travel China in 1 year and you will never ever hear anyone speaking about Marx or Lenin. But you will hear any number of stories about the great emperors of the past, the great dynasties of Confucius and Chinese tradition and Chinese ideology. And that was really what started in 1980 when Deng Xiaoping became the paramount leader in China. They decided to modernize, but they decided to be distinctly Chinese, building upon, yes, an authoritarian tradition in China with a centralized strong state, but it was modernizing with Chinese characteristics. Deng, I think, was very right because he told the Chinese that, hey, we are lagging behind. We need to learn. And interestingly enough, the first place he went to learn was to Singapore. Then he went to Japan and later to the United States, and he told the Chinese, we need to learn, please go abroad to study, please bring the technologies. Chinese companies started copying technologies from other parts of the world, and the rise of China started. But it was very, very clear throughout that it was the rise of China which was the main aim, and it was how to pick foreign technologies and foreign ideas, but to put them into a Chinese context. India is not centralized in the same way as China, so it cannot do this exactly in the same way as China. But I think the method, which is to bring from abroad what is good for India, but put it into an Indian context and with the aim of a strong, dynamic India, and that can be learned from China.
Eric, thank you so much. Veena, just very quick follow-up to that, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely, Bharat.
The bit I was curious about, Eric, was that, yes, I think you've addressed the civilizational aspect of it. On the political front, the Indian constitution has borrowed heavily from Western thought, where, you know, some of those best practices or those ideas have been articulated and enshrined in the Indian constitution. Now, so much so that I think one reason why we've been able to move forward in that journey. I'm not saying that we've done it satisfactorily to anybody's complete happiness, but there is that journey, and I think the constitution has provided us that framework in the pursuit of modernization. Do you think of it as being not? Do you think of it of that architecture not being adequate? Is that why, or is it just a lack of ambition?
I think this is quite interesting because the initial national leaders of India, people like Mahatma Gandhi or Nehru, of course, they have spent quite substantial time abroad. Gandhi had been basically 3 decades abroad before he came back to India in South Africa and in the UK, and also Nehru spent a lot of time abroad. Mao Zedong in China went abroad twice in his life. Both these times were to Moscow. Except for that, he never ever spent any minute outside China. So I think the perspective of Nehru and Gandhi to bring was much more to bring foreign ideas to India. The constitution is very British in its character. The electoral system in India is a copy of the UK electoral system. It may not be the right fit for India, for India to decide, but you could argue that Prime Minister Modi today is much more of a president than a prime minister, and maybe it would have been better to elect him as a president rather than a prime minister. But these, of course, are discussions for Indians to have, not for me. But interestingly enough, India, with this enormous national movement led by Gandhi and others, copied quite a lot from abroad. And the conversation today, I think, is what is the distinctly Indian ideas? Are they religious ideas? Is the Indian national story similar to the Chinese or the Japanese national story, which can be built upon for the Indian identity in the 21st century?
Thank Veena, you want to do a quick reset of the room? Because there are lots of folks at this point.
Yes, I will do a reset. Hello, everybody who has joined this room. The topic for this room today is, should India strive for westernization or modernization? And we have two guests with us today. It is Erik Solheim, who is a Norwegian diplomat and a former politician. He has held several positions in the Norwegian government, and he was also the executive director of the UN Environment Program from 2016 to 2018. We also have with us Suket Dhir, who is a textile and fashion designer. He has been featured on the cover page of several newspapers and magazines, and is also ranked as one of the 50 most influential Indians by GQ magazine. And then, of course, I have with my super cool moderator, co-moderator, Bharat. I would like to move over to Suket, because it's really interesting, Eric, how you give examples from Japan and China, how they have carved out their own path to make their country strong. Suket, you are a designer, and you are also the only Indian Asian who has won the prestigious International Woolmark Prize. How do you view the Indian ethos? Given what Eric is saying, it's up to India to decide the path forward.
Okay, so
you know, I used to, I mean, we've grown up sort of looking at the West, and specifically when it comes to design, you look at the designers from Paris and from London and from Japan, and you see first of all, they some of them are avant-garde, and some of them are, again, they're sort of seeped in aristocratic traditions and crafts of their own regions. For example, I always give this, you know, the shoe industry of Italy, and then again, designers and textile makers of Italy. There's a certain amount of pride of being an Italian brand. And similarly, when you look at Japan, you will see the sword making, you know, the samurai sword. It's actually, you know, people go for like 10, 12 year internships to actually learn the craft of making a sword. It's almost like the Indian concept of tapa, that you have to actually practice it, repeat it, do it over and over and over again till in pursuit of excellence till the time you perfect it. And that's when you can actually become a true master who can create those swords, and those swords fetch that kind of a price. And plus, they've been able to brand it, market it like that. You know, there's this whole cult and this whole reverence around those techniques and concepts, because they talk about that. They talk about the tradition. They talk about importance of the subtle little details that are required. And you have to do certain things a certain way. You can't really sort of take any shortcuts. I think the situation in India has been quite opposite. We've been obsessed, again, I think we were successfully colonized. Our minds were colonized. We've been obsessed with things, doing things the way West does. And whenever we look at our traditions, we look at it in terms of, if it is tradition, it must be regressive and all of that. And plus, even when we look at our craft sector, there's been a people focus, not the craft focus approach of the government. This is private citizens have been focusing on the crafts a lot, 100%. But the governments have not been able to make brands out of these, so that they are more aspirational. Like if for example, there's a textile called Jamdani, there are Banarsi weaves, there are so many other textiles out of India. A couple of them have been successfully become almost reverent, but not there yet. It's the designers associated with those weaves and all of those that have done really, really well. But those weaves themselves have not found a place in the world per se. They are reverent in India. But the techniques and the skills involved in those textiles, in those crafts, are so amazing. They're relevant for the whole world, but they haven't found their place there. So when I went to compete for the International Wool Mark Prize, the only thing I had which was different than my other fellow designers was my upbringing and my experience as an Indian. So, and that would be my USP. But again, it was very, very important for me to not look at it in a dogmatic way. It was very important for me to, again, make it relevant for the world per se, and how to sort of contemporize our techniques, how to contemporize our weaves. That was the question that I was actually looking answers for. And I think I was able to sort of do it successfully. So this is something that I keep asking myself. This is something that I keep talking about. I keep stressing on, again, focusing on traditions, but not in a dogmatic way. And again, see, the thing is, once you make a brand out of one of these weaves, once you make a brand out of one of these crafts, the association with that craft wants the next generation also to continue and get themselves involved. But when you focus only on the craftsmen and the weavers, you know, there's no novelty, there's no aspirational value to be associated with anything. You know, it's just like following your father's footsteps. It's not the reverence of the craft that, I'm going into it just because my father is doing it. Oh, I'm going into it because it is a samurai sword, which the whole world wants to learn, but I have access to. You know what I mean? So that is something, that's the approach that I like to go with.
So, okay, thank you very much. I have to open up the floor for questions from our audience. And Eric, I'm going to bring folks up as many as we can to accommodate as many questions. I want to just maybe quickly let the audience know that we're talking to Eric Solheim and Suket Dheer. We're speaking about whether India should strive for westernization or modernization. We've covered the difference in how they see those two words.
We've also covered some examples such as Japan and China as to how they've gone about something like this and what lessons India might draw from it. Politically, I think Eric has also touched upon the Indian constitution and the ideas that it's assimilated to help India along in that journey. And Suket has spoken about some of these, you know, how the rich traditions of a country like India can very well be, you know, that could be a modernization project in itself. And it's something that I think he's heavily involved in. I'd like to bring up questions. If you want to come up, put your hands up and I'll call you up. But maybe while we wait for people to put their hands up, Veena, one of the questions I may want to have for both Eric and Suket is around, you know, one of the, you know, defining challenges of the 21st century with giants like India and China, purely from the standpoint of being huge markets, right, from a demand standpoint and for companies who want to sell here. Is there a danger that in the process of wanting to bring in more of that investment, more interest into the country, we tend to sort of lose focus around the piece on modernization while encouraging more sort of, should I say, for the lack of a better phrase, aping the West? And I just thought maybe your thoughts on that while I bring in more people. Guys, please do put your hands up and I'll bring you up.
While you think about Bharat's question, I just want to tell everybody that we will stop the recording now. A big thank you to Erik Solheim and Suket Deed for joining us for today's seminar. Please be informed that we will publish the first part of the seminar in a couple of days on our podcast, De Moderne India. Again, a big thank you to all of you who attended our event, and let's continue with the Q&A.